Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Paul Starobin, and welcome to American Beyond on the New Books Network. My guest today is Khalid Elghindi. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, where he also directs that program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian affairs. Khalid previously served as a fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution from 2010 through 2018. And prior to that, he served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009. And he was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations of 2007 and 8. He's also an adjunct instructor in Arab studies at Georgetown University. Welcome, Khalid, to America and Beyond.
Thanks for having me.
So you are the author of a book, Blind Spot: America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. So the first thing I'd like to get at is what you mean by the blind spot. In the book, you call it a systemic blind spot. And if I could just read a little bit on that, a systemic blind spot in America's stewardship of the peace process in two critical areas of diplomacy, power and politics. So, keeping that thought in mind, you also write that in the end, Washington's unique approach to peacemaking did not, and most likely could not, succeed. Indeed, by focusing on reassuring Israel and reforming the Palestinians, rather than on changing the dynamics that sustain the conflict, most notably Israel's ongoing military occupation, the U.S.-led peace process effectively reversed the standard model of mediation. It alleviated pressure on the stronger party and increased pressure on the weaker party. So that's a great principle that you've articulated, stated at the beginning of the book. And what I thought we would do is to go through sort of in order the U.S. presidencies, the administration, starting with Jimmy Carter, that illustrated this systemic blind spot in your terms. So how would you begin that discussion if we could jump ahead a bit in your narrative and go to Jimmy Carter, who, of course, is remembered for the Camp David Accords, the peace with Egypt, and so forth.
Right. So the Carter administration represented, I think, a shift in U.S. thinking, because up until that point, there wasn't really a strong sense that the Palestinians were a political actor in this thing that we called the Arab-Israeli conflict. People generally throughout the 50s, 60s, and much of the 70s looked at Palestinians as a humanitarian issue or as a security issue. They were either refugees or they were guerrilla terrorists and so forth. And so there was a real neglect, I would say, a blind spot for the fact that Palestinians represented a that had political aspirations, that they were, in fact, the core of the Arab-Israeli conflict. It all began in Palestine, the destruction of Arab Palestine, the displacement of most of its population, the denial of the right to self-determination. And so Carter was the first U.S. president really to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. But
where do you think that came from, though, by the way? Was it in any sense a part of his religious sensibility, or was it more political? I mean, why do you think he got at least to that point?
Well, I think it was a function of many different things. Partly his worldview. He was a strong advocate for human rights, and civil liberties and that sort of thing. And that was the core to his administration and the mm-hmm. values that they were projecting. Mm-hmm. And so he saw the Palestinians as this neglected group and as a group of people who were denied basic rights. And he could acknowledge that. But also there had been a shift in the foreign policy establishment in Washington, you know, especially after the 1967 war. And then we saw Palestinian guerrilla groups kind of burst onto the scene in the late 60s and early 70s, sometimes engaging in very dramatic attacks that we would call terrorism, airplane hijackings, things like the Munich Olympics. All of these things, I think, helped to politicize the Palestinian issue in the minds of the foreign policy establishment in Washington and elsewhere. But since we're talking right. primarily the United States, and so that was kind of percolating up in the State Department, within the CIA, in even in the Pentagon.
Okay.
And so you had this convergence right. where people are looking at Palestinians as a political issue. And Carter comes in and he has a very human rights oriented approach to foreign policy.
Right. And so then in terms of what he actually managed to accomplish, I mean, we had the Camp David, you know, peace summit and so forth. How do you think the blind spot manifests itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, the growing awareness of the Palestinians and their aspirations and their kind of the inherently political nature of their struggle was held in check by certain policies that were put in place. So even before Carter became president, the United States, really under the guidance of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who is, I think most people know, was extraordinarily powerful and influential in shaping, you know, obviously U.S. policy in places like Southeast Asia, but also toward the Soviet Union and more globally, including in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And one of his legacies is that he was the architect of the policy that the United States will not talk to the PLO. Which at this point was, you know, certainly from the Palestinian and Arab standpoint, was the representative of the Palestinian people writ large, right. Whether they were in the occupied territories or in the diaspora.
Right. Yasser Arafat, the leader.
Right. And because Israel was staunchly opposed to any kind of recognition of the PLO was recognized, earned observer status at the United Nations in late 1974, much to the chagrin of the United States.
Okay, so two years before Carter's elected.
Right, and so it's not just the Palestinians bursting onto the scene. The PLO has now been recognized by the Arab League, by the United Nations, right. the Soviet Union, and the Israelis are staunchly opposed to any kind of recognition of the PLO. So there is a deal struck, a memorandum between Kissinger and his Israeli counterparts, in which they pledge never to talk to the PLO until they meet two conditions. They recognize Israel's right to exist, and they accept resolution 242, which is the land for peace.
Right.
So, resolution.
So Carter basically abides by that.
Carter comes in and he is sort of, his hands are tied, and he even, you know, he writes in his memoirs about how, you know, Kissinger's memorandum really unfairly restricted his ability to operate as the, you know, chief foreign policymaker. But he is trying to circumvent these restrictions. He's trying to bring the PLO into the peace process by getting them to meet these conditions, by accepting resolution 242 in particular, because that would imply recognition of Israel.
Right.
And he thought if he could do that, he could bring the PLO into the process. But once Sadat decided to move on his own and kind of make a unilateral gesture toward peace with Israel, he kind of dropped the Palestinian issue. So Sadat went to, made his famous visit to Jerusalem.
Right.
And then from there, the Egypt-Israel track blossomed into the peace treaty of 1979. And the Palestinians got relegated to the sidelines.
Right. So it's that relegation that even though we had that, the deal with Egypt. So then, of course, we get Ronald Reagan, who's elected in 1980. And you have this great anecdote in the book where Reagan, this is during the transition, he's being briefed by a CIA guy, knowledgeable guy. And he asks, but they are all terrorists, aren't they? And of course, his briefer is, you know, heart sinks, but there seems to be quite a bit in that question. And I guess the glib way to handle that would be that Ronald Reagan himself sometimes didn't seem to go too far beneath surfaces and was not terribly knowledgeable about some issues. But as I think about that question, it probably embodies more than that, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I think he was speaking, he probably was reflecting the views of a lot of people, not just ordinary Americans,
yeah,
but even folks in Washington, in the, you know, think tank world, mm-hmm. in the policy establishment.
Media environment.
Right. And so there was this perception of Palestinians either as refugees or as terrorists,
right.
But not as legitimate political actors.
Yeah. Or rounded people.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so so there was a learning curve, as you'd expect with any new president, especially one who's not particularly versed in foreign policy and national security issues. And he, you know, after his two terms, after 8 years, he ultimately ended up being the president to establish a formal dialogue with the PLO. So he had traveled quite a distance from the beginning of his administration to the end. You know, there's another anecdote in the book about his Secretary of State talking George Shultz at an AIPAC event in which there's a chant that picks up among the crowd of "Hell no PLO," and he ends up kind of joining this chant, it was him. He was the Secretary of State who established that dialogue many, you know, 5 or 6 years later with the PLO. So there was a huge learning curve throughout the Reagan administration, mm-hmm. In large part because of events on the ground. There was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. There was,
right.
So there was a lot going on that forced
the massacres at Sabra and Shatila.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming up, and there are some, I think, really important lessons from that period to now.
Yeah. And we'll get to the now, but in the leading up. But also what's so interesting, I think, as you're referring to, is that, you know, you have this blind spot, however we, you know, define it exactly, whatever it's the reasons for it are. But there's this constant underplay of events on the ground, which of being events on the ground are really difficult to predict. And so maybe to be charitable, you know, to our policymaking crew, it's awfully difficult to anticipate, you know, what's around the bend.
Right. And so, and like, you know, policies are based on an amalgam of different factors. So there's presidents and secretaries of state have personal views. They bring baggage with them, ideological, cultural, political baggage through which, you know, that's how the lens through which they see the world. And then there's events on the ground. And sometimes there's a gap. very often there's a gap between the perceptions that people come in with, the assumptions.
Right.
And this is the root of the blind spot, is because American officials tend to look at the issue through an Israeli lens, that means certain things get filtered out. And those are usually Palestinian things, Palestinian politics, aspirations, rights. If that's the lens that you look at, and so very often those assumptions kind of come in direct collision with reality, and reality forces new ways of thinking.
And so from Reagan we get to, and I think they're best considered kind of as a duo, George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's vice president, and James Baker, who is a really important force in this administration. And this chapter offers us quite a bit of material in terms of kind of leaning against, in some ways, the sort of prevailing, consensus, or at least the way that things had operated prior to this administration. For example, you talk about a firmer line against Israeli settlement construction. You talk about how they, quote unquote, took on AIPAC. And without giving the game away too much, you also write they were the last American administration to offset some of this imbalance. So that's worth remembering, I think, that that was the character of that administration. And I don't know that we would have necessarily expected that. I kind of superficially, tended to think of the Bush and Baker guys as sort of Texas, oil guys in some ways, and just, not obvious that they would go in that direction, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I think it was also shaped by events on the ground, because Bush came in at the beginning of the Palestinian uprising, the Intifada that was sort of raging on people's TV screens, and people saw essentially stone throwers being met with, Israeli soldiers, sometimes live ammunition, sometimes rubber bullets, but a lot of kind of state violence, and so that shifted impressions of public opinion. But also George Bush was a different kind of president than his predecessor. He was in a lot of ways the exact opposite. He had a lot of foreign policy experience. He was CIA director.
Right.
He had a very nuanced understanding of the world and global conflicts, and so it's not that surprising that he would have a different approach to the Palestinians,
and James Baker was, I think of as kind of a realist, realpolitik, and not too concerned about, that's the way he rolled. And
right, he was a realist, and he was, I think, he was an expert negotiator, I think.
Yeah.
More than anyone, he was he really was a statesman, and he understood. He also wasn't terribly ideological in the way that, say, Henry Kissinger was, who Henry Kissinger was a cold warrior, and that was the lens through which he looked at the world.
Also
the
a rivalry, realist. I mean, he certainly regarded himself as a realist.
A realist in the sense that states and power are what matter, and the power of states as opposed to non-state actors and so forth. But Baker was not bogged down in either the domestic politics part of it or the ideological part of it. And he saw opportunities,
deal maker.
He was a real.
Yeah. Well, maybe he was one that was sensitive to what you describe overall as the dynamic of, like, in any negotiation, you would think that you would need to put more pressure on the, on the stronger party. It's just kind of an obvious, we're just generalizing here, but this in any negotiation, even if you're talking about, labor unions, or not even just in diplomatic relations. So I would imagine that, something like that would be just intuitively obvious to a person like James Baker.
Yeah, and I think this is where the blind spot is probably the thinnest. You know, it's, it, you know, if we think of the blind spot as the result of this kind of lens,
yes,
and worldview through which you look at the conflict,
right?
And he was sort of unencumbered by that, and mm-hmm. he could see the power dynamics for what they were. He could understand the realities on the ground, the geopolitics of it, particularly after, you know, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and that changed the dynamics in the region.
Yes, the Gulf War, the first
right.
Gulf War, as we now call it.
Yeah, and that changed things in a way that he felt he created an opportunity to push for what became the Madrid Conference, to bring Arabs and Israelis together in unprecedented ways, the Syrians, the Lebanese, the Jordanians, who this was before the peace
yeah.
treaty.
What year was the Madrid Peace Conference? That was
1991.
So 1991, okay.
Almost immediately after the Gulf War. And so, of course, he had orchestrated this coalition to oust Saddam Hussein and his forces out of Kuwait. And he used that, he parlayed that coalition into the basis for this regional peace conference.
Yeah. Well, you also write in that the lead up to this conference, you quote a former U.S. diplomat saying, quote, Baker and President Bush stared down the supporters of Israel in Congress. They took on AIPAC and basically beat them. And the crisis caused a lot of turmoil in Israeli in Israel politically. So that seems pretty significant. So they kind of had the cojones to go after, you know, that's to remind our listeners, this is not a small thing. I mean, AIPAC had, you know, kind of a formidable lobbying outfit in Washington, right?
Oh, yeah, it sure did. I think nothing like what it has now.
Yeah, but we're talking also, about then, in the moment, 1991.
In that moment, it was. And I think to a large extent, and I think Baker even put this in kind of crude terms, you know, he felt unencumbered by the domestic politics of it, and AIPAC yeah. in particular, because, as he put it, he said, you know, well, they don't vote for us.
Yeah.
You know, that's not
yeah.
the base of the...
Right. Well, you're talking about the Jewish vote, basically, which is not very large anyway. But yeah, it's historically a Democratic vote. That's just a fact.
It was a Democratic constituency, and also in terms of fundraising.
Yeah.
And so the Republican Party at that time did not depend heavily on big Jewish or pro-Israel donors. The Christian right. That has become today the bedrock, really, of pro-Israel support in the Republican Party, was not anything like its strength and power.
Yeah.
Well,
that's,
you know,
important to note, because I don't think people would necessarily realize that now that we're about 30 plus years from that point of 1991. So in a way, the domestic political environment was not as formidable an obstacle at that time as, you know, one might have
yeah.
thought. And then we can just mention, as an aside, part of this blind spot, I mean, and I don't think there's anything wrong with this, because you see this, you know, Armenian politics, I mean, domestic politics, the Cold War, Poland, are always part of the equation in the making of American foreign policy. So this is not about, oh, well, the Jews or any one particular group. It's just, you know, this is essentially in a pluralistic society. This is what happens, and groups do lobby the Congress and so forth. So I just, maybe a little bit of a, you know, of a clearing of the throat, but just to make that clear. So that was the equation they were dealing with, basically.
Yeah, that was the equation, and he didn't feel that was an obstacle.
And not that many Palestinians, we might add, too. I mean, I don't know what the Palestinian vote was in 1991, but I'm thinking, or the Arab American vote, if you want to enlarge it, but I'm thinking it was probably not very large.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the Arab American vote, it was what the community was not as well organized as they are now. They weren't, you know, you don't have the impact that they have now, for example, in places like Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was not a factor. I mean, the irony, of course, is that Bush was a one-term president.
Yes.
He was quite popular. And then he wasn't. You know, he was on this high, particularly after the Gulf War, and but you know, ended up the economy and other reasons kind of tanked his presidency, and so he was not elected again, reelected.
But Bill Clinton was, and so we can revisit
but
this.
But just to point something out in terms of, you know, as I said, the blind spot was not as prominent in the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush, but it wasn't completely absent. And so I'll just to give a quick example, the U.S. had, under Reagan, had started a dialogue with the PLO. That dialogue ended under the Bush administration a couple, I think it was like 18 months later.
Right.
And it was very uneventful anyway. Dialogue wasn't really going anywhere. And they were trying to bring the Palestinians into the peace process without the PLO because of the baggage of the PLO. So that there was still elements of this kind of contradictory approach where, you know, we'll talk to the Palestinians, we'll acknowledge Palestinian rights and aspirations, but we won't talk to their leaders, or at least, and even when they engineered the Madrid process, the PLO was not invited. They were there and everybody knew they were there, kind of pulling the strings behind the scene, but they weren't formally invited.
Right. And I remember in my sort of Time magazine, you know, growing up period, that some of this is a matter of personalities. I mean, Yasser Arafat, we could talk about him a little bit, but I mean, Americans tend to see a lot of foreign policy issues in terms of personalities, for better or worse. I mean, it's just the way it is. You know, Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev, they had distinct presences. Zelensky today in Ukraine, I mean, we kind of identify him almost with the nation, which, having been to Ukraine, I think is a little bit ridiculous because there's, you know, it's much more complicated than that. But in any case, with respect to Yasser Arafat, I feel like he became this larger than life figure in the American mind for anyone paying attention. It was kind of hard not to pay at least a little bit of attention because he must have been on the, you know, the cover of Time magazine and so forth. So was that
and
one
it wasn't
the,
positive.
It wasn't positive. Of course it wasn't positive. And that's one of the issues I'm raising, was to what extent, you know, that also was sort of part of the problem. I mean, going back to Reagan again, they're all terrorists, aren't they? So, you know, you had that to deal with. And then let's bring Clinton into the picture because, okay, he's now, I mean, he is dealing pretty directly with Yasser Arafat, is he not?
He is. But the interesting thing is how that came about was not a breakthrough in U.S.-Palestinian relations. The PLO was still out in the cold when Clinton came in.
Yeah, 1992, he's elected. So 1993, he takes office.
He takes office, and they're not talking to the PLO. There's no plan to talk to the PLO. The PLO, I think, by a lot of people's estimation in the Clinton administration, the PLO was an obstacle to peace.
Right.
And then there was this secret track that was developed between Israelis and Palestinians directly.
Oslo.
The Oslo track.
Yeah.
And it was that, you know, it was illegal in the U.S. to talk. They couldn't legally talk to the PLO. In Israel, it was even more illegal.
Yeah, like with the Iranians, it often is.
They could be jailed in Israel for meeting with the PLO. And some were. And yet, at the highest levels, the Rabin government, Yitzhak Rabin government at that time, authorized this secret dialogue with the PLO that eventually led to the Oslo process. And so that forced the United States to play catch up. So the Clinton administration could not be more Catholic than the Pope in this case. And so, of course, once Israel started talking to the PLO directly and recognized them, then the U.S. had to follow suit. And so they had to make all of these quick changes in U.S. law to allow, dealings directly with the PLO, and eventually even for funds to flow through the PLO to the newly created Palestinian Authority.
I mean, just to remind, so the Oslo basically was set the groundwork for Palestinian self-rule in 5 years, created this new Palestinian Authority, and was supposed to lead to these permanent status negotiations. So That all sounds pretty substantial, actually.
Yeah, it was a major breakthrough because the first time Israel and the PLO formally recognized each other and were talking directly under now U.S. auspices. And so everyone remembers maybe the famous handshake on the White House lawn between the two, between Arafat and Rabin.
Yeah.
With President Clinton in the middle, sort of beaming, you know, and the
and
U.S.
It was huge. I mean, just to remind, I mean, this was, you know, not just front page New York Times. This was everywhere. Television. I mean, it was a, you know, huge moment in American life at that time. I mean, given all the attention on this conflict. So it was all in focus.
It was. It was. And I think a lot of people felt like it was a historic moment that would eventually lead to an end to conflict.
Yeah. Were you involved in that in any way, by the way? How old were you at that point? I'm just curious.
I was a grad student. I was a grad student in at Georgetown. And so, you know, I was watching it in real time.
How did it look? How did it look? I mean, were you excited? Were you feeling, you know, what was your perspective on it?
Yeah, I was, you know, I will say I was skeptical. I think I felt like a lot of people, you know, it sounds a lot like Camp David, the Camp David autonomy plan, you know, that Palestinians would have
under Carter.
Five years of autonomy, and then there would be permanent status negotiations, and they put off all the hard issues until later. And so I was not a fan of that process of putting off the core issues.
Okay.
But I think like a lot of people, I was willing to give it the benefit of the doubt and let's see where this goes.
I mean, at least the top players are directly, they've got skin in the game.
Yeah. And there was no question that this was like a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
I mean, Rabin of all people, Mr. Yeah. You know, break their bones in the Intifada. Yeah. And so for him to acknowledge and come to terms with the PLO, and now that PLO is established in the occupied territories and they're setting up a government called the Palestinian Authority, there were things that you could point to that looked like we were on a trajectory toward Palestinian statehood. And so there was a sense of optimism, even as a lot of us were skeptical.
And then we get to things like there's so many of these different summits, the Y River Plantation Summit, you know, Camp David again, and lots of stuff happening. I mean, it punctuated and, you know, again, not to give away the game, but you have Clinton towards the end of his administration furious, telling the George W. Bush team with respect to Arafat, quote, "Don't ever trust that son of a bitch."
So
that doesn't sound like actually like a blind spot. I want to not to play with that too much. That sounds more like I see this clearly and I'm really pissed off about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot happened for Clinton to get to that point. And that was after the failure of the Camp David summit. And more importantly, the failure of the negotiations that came afterward in the remaining, you know, 3-4 months of his term. And so the Camp David,
all the core issues, as you mentioned.
Right. And so Camp David itself was not as significant as the negotiations that ensued the rest of the fall in September, October, November, and then in December before he left office.
We're talking about 2000.
Of 2000. And the problem with that moment was you had the second Intifada had started in that moment. And unlike the first Palestinian uprising, this one was kind of weaponized or militarized. There were it was much bloodier. And it wasn't just, you know, Palestinians throwing stones. And so you now had a very high body count by the end of 2000 on the Palestinian side primarily. And there were also Israeli casualties. And so both sides were kind of dug in to their positions because of the violence. And but
Right.
even then, Clinton was very invested in the issue. He put forward kind of a bridging proposal called the Clinton parameters and basically laid them out. Here are the basic guidelines for a framework for an agreement. And he put them to the two leaders. The two leaders accepted them with reservations,
Right.
As is often done. And so they saw that, Clinton saw that as a basis to push the process. He was hoping to clinch a deal
Right.
before January 20th, before he had to leave office.
Right.
It didn't happen.
Right.
And so his anger kind of spilled over, and it ultimately, at the end of the day, and this is where the blind spot comes in, is if you're going to lay blame somewhere, you're going to do it, you're going to blame the weak link. And
yeah.
the weak link is always the Palestinians because of the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
He kicked at the weaker party, basically, so
yeah.
to speak. And so we see that, and I mean, we could spend a lot of time on each one of these, but
sure.
let's go to George W. Bush, who maybe doesn't merit an enormous amount of attention here. I mean, you write that he scaled back the U.S. involvement in the peace process and saw basically no value in engagement. There's this whole kind of neo-conservative thread to what's happening in the George W. Bush administration. Of course, we have this quote-unquote war on terror following 9/11, the attack on Iran. I mean, Iraq that he instituted, quite a bit going on. And we have also Hamas kind of coming into the picture in an important way with winning a majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council, and I believe that was 2006. And so let's bring in actually Condi Rice here as another person, because I think she's kind of important. I remember hearing her say how astonished she was that Hamas won this majority in those elections. And I remember thinking, and I'm hardly an expert on the releases, why would you be astonished? So
yeah.
I don't know if that's part of the blind spot, but it struck me there was this kind of weird, almost naivete about what was actually happening in Palestinian politics. Condi Rice was kind of a specialist in the Soviet Union, really.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it was the blind spot per se. A lot of people were surprised. I think the Palestinian leadership was surprised.
Were you surprised?
I think even Hamas was surprised. I was surprised.
Okay.
I think people expected that Fatah would, all the polls were showing Fatah would win. And if very few people were predicting a Hamas upset. And I think Hamas itself was not expecting to win and were not planning to be able to form a government on their own. They weren't ready for that.
Okay,
and,
well, I
and
don't
so
know why I
were,
felt so cynical about it then, maybe, but
yeah,
I remember
I mean,
not feeling surprised, but okay.
Yeah, in hindsight, just given everything that had happened up until then, the destruction of the Palestinian Authority during the Second Intifada, like physically it was destroyed, not just its police forces, but also ministries were completely gutted by the Israeli military. Arafat's compound, if you remember, was surrounded and demolished by Israeli tanks, and he was under siege. And so it was a really, really difficult time. So in hindsight, yeah, you could see how that adversity of that period, Palestinians were in the mood for something very different. And they weren't going to, you know, it's like you always blame the party that's in power when things are going wrong.
Right.
And that's what
okay.
happened. I mean, you're right in that you had the right instinct in that the conventional wisdom would have dictated that the party in power was going to lose because they oversaw all this mayhem and destruction.
Yeah.
But nobody expected Hamas to win an outright majority.
Okay.
And so when they did, nobody was ready for it, least of all the two main political actors,
right.
Hamas and Fatah.
And we can note in passing that Arafat actually dies in 2004, and he's succeeded
right.
by the current head of the Palestinian Abbas. And anyway, and I think we can cover this briefly, but we do have this 2007 Annapolis Conference, which is a kind of Condi Rice operation. And at least in part, this is about strengthening the PA, the Palestinian Authority, over Hamas.
Yeah. I mean, for me, this is the moment when the blind spot becomes clear. And this is this
so to
is
speak.
The, yeah, right. I mean, this is where the idea for the book actually came from. It
okay.
was it was it 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 grew out of this moment after, in the summer of 2007, when you had this growing tension between Hamas and Fatah. Hamas is the government. There was an attempt at creating a unity government that the U.S. and Israel completely rejected, and that basically pushed the Palestinians into a civil war that Hamas won. So Hamas ends up kicking the PA out of Gaza. They take control. And it was in that moment that the split that we now have, this after 17 years, between Hamas and Fatah is born. And it was right in that moment that the American side decided, aha, this is when we're going to push for permanent status negotiations, when the Palestinian leader, who is already at a disadvantage, you know, given the asymmetry between Palestinians and Israel, but who has just lost a civil war, his PA forces were routed in Gaza, and 18 months before that had lost an election. And so it just seemed odd to me that people thought this was the best moment to push for a peace process. And so that's where the blind spot comes in, where it's like, wow, they really don't see Palestinian politics as somehow significant or playing into power dynamics at all.
Right, right. And now, again, we understand more time can be spent, but I think that's a great setup actually for the transition to Barack Hussein Obama, who, again, you know, at least superficially, you would think here's a guy who had spent some time like growing up in Indonesia. I mean, a really sort of worldly figure in lots of ways. You know, 2009, the Cairo quote unquote speech to the Muslim world. He cited the quote pain of dislocation of the Palestinian refugees, the daily humiliation of occupation. I mean, my take on Obama, a lot of people's take, was he was kind of all about empathy. I mean, it almost seemed to define his political identity. So somebody maybe well equipped to deal with this, and as a person, perhaps not so likely to have possession of a blind spot. And you do refer to his initially tough stance on Israeli settlements. So maybe some hope from your perspective with Obama's elevation to the Oval Office?
Yeah, I think certainly there was a lot of hope when Obama came in, because he had a very different approach, and he had contacts with Palestinians. He had an awareness of Palestinian suffering before he became president. We heard this from different Palestinian intellectuals, that Palestinian Americans who he had dealt with.
Yeah.
And so he did have a different outlook, and that manifested itself very early on in his administration when he appointed a special envoy, George Mitchell, on day one of his of his presidency.
The main senator who had pretty strong credentials in this Department of Peacemaking.
Right. He exactly. And he had brokered the Good Friday Agreement
in Northern Ireland.
And so he had the bona fides for sure.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was also well regarded by both Israelis and Palestinians, he was the right man for the job. And so it looked like a very serious push that he was going to make. But he very quickly ran up against the wall of domestic politics and Israeli politics, because now you had Netanyahu coming into office around the same time in early 2009. And so there are structural constraints. He is only able to do so much. And the Republican Party of 2009 is not the Republican Party of George H.W. Bush or even Ronald Reagan. This is a very different animal.
Yeah.
And any kind of, even upholding international law, talking about Resolution 242 and the 1967 lines, was regarded as beyond the pale by by the right wing in the Republican Party, and they accused Obama of throwing Israel under the bus.
Yeah. So in a way, what we call the Overton window, which we often think of as expanding, had kind of shrunk.
Exactly. And so it's not that he has a blind spot. Some in his administration
he
do.
Obama,
but
right.
He, Obama. But it's kind of like with Carter, the constraints that were put in place before he got there, the structural constraints, basically railroaded him. It just kind of hamstrung him, and he came up, it was a dead end when he tried to push the issue.
Almost too generous in the sense that you describe the Obama paradox, which sounds at least in part like to some degree a function of personality. You know, you describe him as, you know, sympathetic to the grievances as he would expect, but not really willing to apply pressure on Israel. And I know, okay, domestic politics, but, you know, we've discussed before James Baker, maybe there was something in Obama that just, he just maybe didn't quite have that kind of spine.
Yeah, I mean, he got burned in his first term trying to tackle this issue. He went all in, ran into this brick wall, and said, okay, I'm done. I tried, you know. And then even in his second term, when you would think that as a lame duck, he's got more freedom, he has more flexibility, he had in the person of John Kerry, Secretary of State, who was very enthusiastic
after
about
Hillary
the issue.
Clinton, yeah.
But he himself had divested himself from he's like, you know, if Kerry wants to run with it, go for it.
Well, that's not going to work then, right? I mean, it has to come,
from the top. He was not going to expend a lot of political capital on the issue.
And so we're back to that issue. Okay, now we're going to get to Donald Trump, where your book concludes, but your sort of headline on Trump is, quote unquote, indifference.
Yeah.
So, which seems to say quite, I'm not sure much more needs to be said, but, you know, that's what you say.
I will say I wrote that. So the book came out after only the it goes through the end of 2018. And so we're talking about less than a year and a half into his administration. And so it's not the full picture, obviously. So it's before his peace initiative.
Well, right, of course. Your book comes out when it comes out.
The Abraham Accords. Yeah. And so if I was going to rewrite that chapter, I would
update
modify it.
It
wasn't just indifference, it was actual hostility.
Well, did indifference become hostility, or were they
indifference became hostility? Yes. I think initially he tried to show, look, I'm going to deal with this issue. He met with Netanyahu, but he also invited Mahmoud Abbas to the White House. And he felt like there was Palestinians, I thought naively, but, you know, they thought at a minimum, we'll fake it till we make it. You know, if this guy thinks he's the great deal maker, we'll indulge that and see where he's willing to go. And the fact that he's not deeply ideological, he's seen as kind of opportunistic and transactional.
Yeah.
You know, Palestinians were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Transactional is okay if depending on the nature of the transaction you're trying to accomplish.
Right. But the moment that he kind of went to the extreme on the other side and recognized Israel, Jerusalem as Israel's capital,
right,
reversing not 50 years of U.S. policy, but it was 70 years of U.S. policy.
Yeah.
That was something that was the red line for the Palestinians. And they knew that this was a completely different kind of presidency.
Yeah. Well, my only comment on the margins of that is basically I kind of see a root quality in Trump of being not curious about anything much in particular. And I don't know how you can master something like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict without at least some level of curiosity. And, you know, you don't expect presidents to read every book on the shelf, of course, but some at least try. I mean, Bill Clinton, for all that could be said about him, I think he was actually pretty curious about foreign affairs. I mean, he famously read these books on the Balkans and Robert Kaplan and so forth. So, you know, I think it kind of takes that, which brings us now to the present. I know that Joe Biden is not the focus of your book, which, as we have noted, ended midway kind of in the Trump administration. But have you thought at all about how Biden and what's happening today can fit into this construct of the blind spot?
I absolutely have. And I feel like Biden personifies the blind spot in its most absolute and purest form.
Wow.
It really is, because it wasn't just, you know, with all the previous administrations, it was, you know, as I said, certain things get filtered out when you look at the issue through an Israeli lens. And sometimes the lens is thicker, more opaque than other times.
Yeah.
In this case, it wasn't just Palestinian rights and politics that are being filtered out, but even Palestinian humanity in the case of Joe Biden, where early on, as the casualties became extraordinarily high, it was clear, I think, in the first week or two that this was an extraordinarily destructive Israeli military campaign, obviously following, you know, October 7th. Atrocities. But there was, you know, and here we are now, 5 months in, more than 30,000 dead. Most of Gaza is in ruins. The civilian infrastructure has been destroyed. Most of its hospitals are destroyed. The health sector has been completely collapsed. People are literally starving to death. You have human rights groups are saying starvation is being used as a weapon of war. Israel is deliberately restricting humanitarian aid. And yet, we still can't get a ceasefire. We still can't, you know, there's talk about a pause for 6 weeks, but also a kind of resignation to, well, Israel is still, they are insisting on finishing the job in Rafah and displacing the 1.5 million who've already been displaced there to somewhere else. And there's no end to the suffering. And it's really astonishing. that the Biden administration is allowing this to continue, because not just the human costs are, I think, unacceptable, but the reputational costs to the United States, the stability costs, how anyone would imagine that the annihilation of Gaza, the destruction of all of its universities and hospitals and its civilian infrastructure, was somehow going to make Israelis more secure. It's an incredibly reckless kind of approach, and one that I think necessarily devalues Palestinian life. Otherwise, how can it be argued that this level of death and destruction is acceptable, much less constructive? And so all of that, I think, is a function of the person of Joe Biden and his deep, deep personal attachment to Israel, which really blinds him to the reality of what Palestinians are enduring.
Is there anybody, is there any prospect of how to put it, showing Joe Biden, I mean, somebody in his administration, that there needs to be this, you know, they wouldn't, of course, say you have a blind spot, Mr. President, but, you know, kind of steering him or suggesting other, I mean, we've seen a little bit with Kamala Harris maybe in recent days. It's hard to say, frankly, when she showed up in Selma, I was thinking, well, is this domestic politics as much as anything else? We should remind everyone that we're in the midst of an election that in November that almost certainly will feature the current president against Donald Trump in a rematch. Somebody like Tony Blinken, I actually find to be a sort of interesting figure in the sense that with respect to Ukraine, for example, I do think he's actually a fairly curious, sophisticated, you know, person who's been around Biden forever. I mean, the one time I spent a lot of time with Biden was in his Senate office. It was shortly after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, well, maybe a year or two after, and, you know, spend a good hour with him. And, you know, Blinken was there every moment of it, and clearly somebody he trusts and depends on. So I wonder a little bit about that, whether there's this prospect at all of penetrating the blind spot. We should also mention, I mean, you know, since everything moves so quickly, we are talking on Tuesday, March 5th, and the president will have his State of the Union address in 2 days. And I have to believe he's going to talk at least a little bit about this. So amidst all of this kind of darkness, is there any prospect, do you think, of a sort of an enlightenment?
You know, he has a lot of very capable people in his administration, as you said, but capable, but also very, I think, reasonable. Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, you know, these are smart guys. Kamala Harris, they know, you know, they know things. And we also know.
And hear from people, probably. I'm sure Kamala Harris, example, she must hear from lots of people outside the White House about perceptions and so forth.
And we've seen the protests across the country. We've seen how, you know, any member of this administration gets hounded in any public event.
The Michigan primary uncommitted vote.
We've seen unprecedented mobilizations, particularly against a war that the U.S. doesn't have boots on the ground. That is unprecedented. So the Democratic Party base is very far away from where the president is. And so even there, right, even the domestic political cost doesn't seem to have moved the needle. And it's not that people don't know what's happening. They know what's happening. And there's a lot of dissent inside the administration. We've heard about numerous dissent memos in being circulated in the State Department.
Oh, yeah. People have resigned.
A couple people have resigned. But there's also this sense, it's, I think, held in check by the fact that people are looking at this election coming up as an existential one, that the future of American democracy is at stake.
Right.
Particularly since, you know, it looks like Trump is going to be the Republican nominee.
Certainly.
And so people don't want to fall on their sword, I think, and ultimately end up hurting a Democratic president by kind of distancing themselves overtly.
Well, that's less of a blind spot than the way you're describing it,
and
more of a like, yeah, we know, but you could say that's a moral sellout, perhaps, if you want to describe it that way. But it's not so much a blind spot.
Yeah, no, the blind spot is in relation to the president and his immediate circle of people who have decided that this level of Palestinian death and suffering and destruction is acceptable. Because it will make Israelis more secure, or at least it will make Israelis feel more secure.
Right. So
they are devaluing the impact on Palestinians necessarily, because somehow it's seen that the greater good is that, you know, destroying Hamas will bring peace and stability. When really, I think any rational person, a person who is not blinded by a personal devotion to Israel, and ignoring the fact that Israel is run by the most extreme government in the country's history, with literal supremacists inside the cabinet making decisions. You know, Israeli citizens are blocking humanitarian aid trucks from entering Gaza while people are starving. So this is the mood that Israel is in. And to just defer almost entirely to an extreme government in a moment of national trauma in which there's a desire for revenge, and we hear the kind of language coming out of Israeli leaders and public figures, is quite,
right,
I would call it even genocidal. And well, they to just would say, completely defer to that, that's where the blind spot comes in, is not seeing the consequences of that deference to what Israel is doing.
Yeah, the administration would probably say something about it, aren't they? Like sanctioning, they've got this sanctions list of various politicians associated with the settlements.
Four individual settlers.
Four individual settlers. Okay, I just, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not speaking for the administration, but I just
thought it's powerful tool potentially that is used on a microscopic level.
Right. Well, here we are again. We're speaking, you know, 2 days before his State of the Union address, and we're winding down. But why don't I will give it to you for the should part. I mean, you know, he'll always be speaking to the nation in 2 days about this, just, you know, briefly. But what should he say with respect to this? Should he do?
What he should have said.
Should say now.
Ago,
should say now.
Right. Here we, is here what we he are. Should say now is there's no military solution to this conflict. If 5 months of horrific violence and the almost complete destruction of Gaza as a society, it has been rendered uninhabitable. If this level of death and destruction is not enough to convince people that there's no military solution, then I don't know what is. But people need to understand there is not a military solution. There is only a political solution.
So he should call for
an immediate and permanent ceasefire, because Hamas will not be destroyed. Attempting to do that will only add tens of thousands more dead. And right now, the Israelis are preparing to invade the last part of Gaza, where they have forced everyone to flee to. And it is going, if they move ahead with that, we're going to see far more bloodshed than what we've already seen. There is no way to provide for the safety of civilians in this context. So this war just has to end.
And beyond calling for a ceasefire, what should there be a further, like an articulation of the vision?
I mean, they talk about a two-state solution and that they're serious about pushing ahead with that. I don't know how they're going to do that when you have an Israeli government in place that is not only opposed to Palestinian state. Netanyahu brags about he's the one who's prevented a Palestinian state. But that doesn't even acknowledge and is actually working to dismantle the very idea of a Palestinian people. And they're doing it in Gaza, certainly. They're doing it in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem. And so this administration's kind of blind support for Israel militarily and diplomatically is, I think, really doing enormous damage to American credibility, not to mention, you know, Palestinian lives.
And on that note, we will have to end. Thank you, Khalid. And this has been Paul Starobin for America and Beyond on the New Books Network.